What does true wellness mean to you? I'm Claudia Cometa, and that is the question I will be leading with in the Minding Wellness podcast. Each and every week, I will bring you experts who will share their personal wellness journeys and their insights into what it means to mind our wellness. Health is a state of body. Wellness is a state of being. Let's dive into improving our state of being. Welcome to episode 33 of the Minding Wellness podcast. Today I have Alicia Decker. She is a dear friend, colleague, and classmate of mine who graduated from the University of Florida in 2003 with her doctorate of pharmacy. She has dedicated her career to the true heroes of our country, our veterans, and currently serves as the pharmacy quality manager at the Orlando VA. As a mom of two and devoted wife, she finds herself with limited time, but is a master at prioritizing and executing on life's important moments. 9 years ago, she found herself on the other side of the healthcare equation as a patient, and it is this experience and the insights gained that we focused on for this episode. Enjoy. I am so excited to have my dear friend and colleague, Alicia Decker, with me here today. We actually go kind of way-ish back. We went to pharmacy school together here at the University of Florida, and we kind of kept in touch over the years, although I moved around quite a bit. You know, social media definitely helps keep us in touch. And then we have more recently, once I moved back to the Gainesville area, have kept in touch a lot closer and have become really good friends. And I knew her story would be so impactful and insightful to so many that I asked her to come on, and she agreed. And I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for being here, Alicia.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Claudia.
Yeah, so fun. So as you know, I start with this one question with all of my guests, and so I'm going to ask you as well. And the question is, what does true wellness mean to you?
So true wellness means to me just feeling good in your skin and feeling like you can do the things that you want to do. I don't pretend to be a super fit, you know, I don't exercise a lot because I just am so crazy busy, but I eat well and I take advantage of as much movement as I can get in during the day with work and with the kids and with business, anything that I can do to get activity in and just feel good in what I'm doing every day and being able to keep up with my everyday activities. That would be what true wellness is for me.
Absolutely. And I can definitely testify, being a close friend of Alicia's, that she is extremely busy, but she absolutely does do what she can in the time that she has. And I do think that it's super important to get to the point where we feel like we can do the things that we want to do and that we enjoy doing, and do it in a feeling of a well and healthy state. So absolutely to that. So what I would love to do now is start diving into your story. So I did mention that we both went to pharmacy school, and so we definitely have shared that with the audience that we are both pharmacists. But what I want to focus on this episode is specifically your healthcare journey and, you know, all of the insights that came from that. So let's just start diving in. So start sharing. And I know that there are a lot of pieces to it. So I know it's going to be hard to try to summarize it, but let's start off with your story and your own words.
So it all started back in September 2010. And the story chronologically is pretty easy to follow. And around, I think it was Labor Day, I had a really bad pain in my abdomen, and being a mom of young kids, so this was 9 years ago, so my kids were 9 years younger than they are now, so two and almost five, and so I felt this pain, and I kind of wanted to ignore it, like most moms and women do. We tend to think, okay, there is no time for this, I cannot get sick, it's probably, you know, it's probably gas or something I ate or something. So I was just trying to push it away. Well, the pain was very persistent, and it was in an area that I really couldn't link it to any organs or anything that's in there. Being in the medical field, and my husband's in the medical field as a nurse practitioner, I knew what was in that area, and there really wasn't anything that concerned me. So I was, my plan was just kind of to push through this pain and wait for it to go away. Well, being a daughter of an Italian mother, my mom had other plans when she saw that I was in pain, and she said, you know, let's just go pop by the ER and see what they have to say. And I'm like, no, I've got things to do. We have a barbecue to go to. We're going out to the beach. You know, I do not have time to get sick. So, my brother actually happened to be an inpatient at the time at the same hospital where my mom wanted me to go. She said, let's go visit your brother and we'll just pop into the ER real quick and what they have to say. And so I begrudgingly, you know, went to the ER with my mom, and, really the fact that it was so persistent and nothing was making it go away. I was taking Gastex, I was taking, you know, antacids, anything I could to try to make this pain go away. It wouldn't go away. So went to the ER thinking that they would say, okay, lady, you just, you know, had something for breakfast that didn't agree with you. So they did a CT scan, and I remember sitting still in pain and sitting in the ER, and a nurse practitioner, I believe, came in the room after my scan and said, you have a mass on your pancreas. And at that moment, like, I will never forget the way that those words fell on my ears, because first of all, not really the way that you present anything on the pancreas. And I immediately kind of saw and heard my life flash before my eyes. I recall not having much of a reaction at that point because I was kind of in shock. Like, that can't be. I'm 32 years old. That doesn't make a lot of sense, but okay. So she says, okay, we're going to send you for an MRI. So I wait the 2+ hours for the MRI, which, as somebody who was just pretty much told it's likely that you have pancreatic cancer, that was a long 2 hours just sitting and waiting and thinking, my kids are at home, and what do I tell my husband? He's not here, and who's going to raise my kids? And, you know, I am seeing their life flash before my eyes. And so I went for the MRI, and I will never forget it. You know, they ask you if you want to play music, and this is an important part of my story, so I always include it. And they ask you what kind of music you want to play in the earphones because the MRI is so loud. And I remember I always ask for contemporary Christian because that's what I tend to listen to. It's so uplifting. And I put on the earphones, and as soon as I put them on, one of my favorite groups, Casting Crowns, was playing Praise You in the Storm. And I remember feeling just this flood of that God was with me, and that whatever I was going to find out, that it was going to be okay. And I needed to praise God for what, you know, this is my storm, and I will never, and when that song comes on, I still get chills because I feel like that song was put in my ears at the time, and I'm waiting for them to find out what exactly they saw. So moving on throughout, they decided to admit me because they really did not know, and they did confirm on the MRI that there was something there. And they ended up the first week that I was in the hospital, they did some tests, and I actually was able to talk them into letting me go home while I waited for test results. And because actually, ironically, about 2 days after I was admitted, the pain went away. That pain that brought me in the first place went away. They never found to this day something wrong in that area. The pancreas is not located on the lower left side. There is nothing that could explain the pain that I had. So again, I totally believe that it was a divine intervention that I was in that ER on that day, because that pain would have gone away and I would have never seen what they saw. So I went home, and I remember, just kind of being nervous and not knowing, and just hoping that they weren't going to find anything, that the blood work and the pathology and everything would come back fine. It ended up that the pancreatic surgeon that had seen me when I was admitted that week called me on Saturday morning. And I remember he said, okay, so the normal blood tests that we normally would do to detect some kind of cancer in the pancreas. Normally it's like less than 100, abnormal is greater than 200, and yours was 150 or something. It was something in the middle area. I don't remember exactly, but I remember him saying it's just inconclusive, but it's not negative. So he said, bring your mom, bring your husband, come see me in the office on Monday. So of course the rest of that weekend was super fun. And I just tried to put it out of my mind. And on Monday morning we went and saw the pancreatic surgeon, who is a doll, like he's the best ever. And thank God that he was put in my life. But, after the test came back, they said, look, he said, based on your age, if you were older, I would say we watch and wait because we don't know what exactly it is. And, it's tiny and you don't, you know, all the other blood work is normal, but this one cancer marker is just like a little bit off. But because you're young, and I think that you, you know, I don't want to take a chance, we're going to do major surgery. So he explained to me with big words, I'm going to take out your spleen. Or no, he didn't tell me about the spleen. He said, I'm going to take out the kind of the tail end of your pancreas. So the pancreas has a head, which has most of the mass of the pancreas, and then the tail, which is long, but it's probably maybe about a third of the total pancreas. So of course I'm like totally freaked out. I'm a needle phobe. I'm an everything phobe. I do not like to have anything sharp near me, let alone have a massive abdominal surgery. And so he talked about risks and, you know, 50% chance I'd be diabetic because the pancreas is where your insulin is made. So, you know, if they mess that up, that can go bad. And, you know, the risks. And I also recalled back when my husband was in, right after we got married, he was in the hospital and the surgeon had a surgery and the surgeon had to move his pancreas and he ended up with severe pancreatitis just from looking at the pancreas, basically. So the thought of them cutting into the pancreas was very scary for me. So we scheduled that surgery and it was September 22nd, 2010. Again, a date I will never forget. And everything went okay. They ended up taking out the tail end of my pancreas, like I said, but where the lesion was that they saw was the splenic artery was going right over it. So they couldn't dissect it out. So they ended up removing my spleen as well and my gallbladder because I had gallstones. So they went ahead and just did a 3-for-1 surgery. So I came out 3 organs later and, or 2.5 organs later and, recovery was difficult. And I was very hopeful because the first week after surgery was pretty non, you know, there was nothing really to speak of that had happened. So I was in the hospital over a week, went home and ended up with an infection, had to come back, I ended up, long story short, back in the hospital over the course of 6 months. I believe I was hospitalized 5 or 6 times. I had multiple fluid collections, which is a risk when you mess with the pancreas. So I, on multiple hospitalizations, they had to put drains in, which were incredibly unpleasant. And it was a long and tedious recovery. I ended up 3 months later to the day on December 22nd, having to have a second surgery because I developed what's called a pseudocyst, which is a kind of encapsulated fluid collection that is very common, a very known complication of having surgery on your pancreas. Now, what was interesting and super scary is after they did the pathology, so they looked at what they took out under the microscope and they found 2 separate lesions on the pancreas, completely unrelated to each other. So they were not like 2 of the same spots. It was 2 completely different origins, 2 completely different, I guess, masses, and unrelated, equally precancerous. So basically my surgeon and I actually did a special for the hospital. We did a new special, and I remember him saying that had they not detected this, that by age 40, which is the age that I am right now, that I would have had pancreatic cancer. This is how it starts. And it is incredibly rare that that they would ever detect something like this before it becomes cancer. So I am eternally grateful and eternally lucky that this pain brought me into the hospital in the first place for them to be able to detect what had happened. So after the second surgery, which was right around Christmas, I ended up getting out right before New Year's. And then I landed back in the hospital one final time for one additional surgical infection. And then at the very end of all of it, I got a call from my doctor that the fluid in the pseudocyst, which was the surgery I had in December, had grown out a very kind of a rare and strange bacteria that required basically the equivalent to tuberculosis, but in my pancreas fluid. So I ended up having to have another year plus treatment with this infectious disease specialist, just trying to figure out how do you clear mycobacterium from inside the body that's not in the lungs where it normally would be a pathogen. But after all of that, I finally went back to work after about 6 months and have been feeling great and incredibly grateful for everyone that participated. My surgeon and I actually have a date every year around the same time. He actually graduated me 2 years ago to 2 year surveillance. So I'm coming up with my 2 year surveillance coming up here actually on my birthday, where he'll look again just to make sure. So we are constantly monitoring to make sure, because I'm such an anomaly, they don't really know what the future holds, but I'm just really grateful to be here and to have, you know, gotten through what I got through and to be able to speak about it. And the biggest thing for me is listen to your body, because that I did not want to. And had I not, then, you know, things could have ended up a lot differently.
Your story is so impactful that even me listening to this, and I know that we've both talked about this about each other, like every time there's a new detail that I either forgot or didn't know. And I am finding myself just hearing you talk about the music and the Praise You in the Storm, and it's like bringing me to tears. And I don't know why I don't remember that part of your story, but it's like, it's such a strong visual and even auditory feeling that I could just hear that and how impactful that piece of your story is. So many questions and so many parts to sort of dive into. I think my first question is, you know, we're both relatively, you know, strong, independent healthcare providers and professionals, and this is not anything that any of us in the field assume we're going to have to deal with. You know, we're always the ones that are taking care of others, and it's rare for us to go through something this in depth as a patient, and also for John, your husband, to have gone through a very serious round of months of, you know, being a patient as well. What is it like, you know, having your years of schooling and then actively engaging with and treating patients, and then to be the patient, also to be the advocate for your husband who was the patient? What are those role switches like, and how did you handle that? And then how does that now affect how you are in your job now?
So that's a really great question. As a patient, I actually become intellectually stunted. It's almost like when my kids are sick and I'm afraid to use my own knowledge to treat my kids or to know what to do with my own kids, that I need somebody else to tell me what to do. Believe it or not, I did not even want go onto Google, go onto UpToDate, go onto any of the medical references that I have and research what they found and what I potentially had. I know that is really rare. It's probably even more rare for a medical professional not to learn everything there is to know, mainly because I was so scared about what I might find, and I didn't think it was going to be important, and I didn't think it would help me in any part of my recovery. As a patient, I really did not ask a lot of questions. I really besides being so, I was so sick and in just so much pain and discomfort. I, you know, looking back, I'm shocked because of the type of job that I do now. I'm shocked that I did not look at every single thing that they did to me. I did advocate for myself when it came to people sticking needles in me. That became a really big issue. My mom worked her entire career as a lab manager and actually was the lab manager at the time in the hospital I was admitted at. So she stayed in my room every night and worked in my room, brought her laptop and worked from my room a good portion of most of the days that I was admitted. And when it came time for an IV change or a blood draw, I typically would have her call one of her technologists up or one of their phlebotomists up because it was so painful and very traumatic for me because my veins were there. They still are. They're so sensitive because of the number of IVs and the number of drugs that they had to push through my veins. It became very traumatic for me, and it always has been. I've always been very afraid of needles and everything, but that was one thing I did speak up about, like, get somebody else. You know, I like you as a nurse, but please get somebody from the lab because I know that they do 100 times more phlebotomies than the nurses do. And so that was something I definitely advocated for, but a lot of it was my network, my friends and family that advocated for me. I had two of my closest friends from work at the time, and we're still very close friends. They were nurses in quality management, and they are the ones that sent me back to the hospital for this after my first surgery because they saw the wound and said, that's infected. And I totally was oblivious. And my husband as a nurse practitioner was totally oblivious, just trying to take care of our kids and trying to make sure that I didn't push myself too hard. So they looked at the wound and immediately said, that's infected. You need to go back to the doctor immediately. And it was, and they admitted me. I had another time, my same friends came to visit me in the hospital, and they had just put in a PICC line. It was probably my fourth or fifth hospitalization. They finally decided to put a PICC line, thank God. And I was having what I felt like I felt fluttering in my chest. I'm like, man, my heart rate feels like it's really fluttering. And she goes, she used to be an ICU nurse. And she said, they put the PICC line in too far. You need to get them. She went to my nurse and said, get them back here. You need to do an X-ray. The PICC line is causing her to be an AFib. And they did, it was, and they fixed it. Mm-hmm. So it was really quite astonishing the amount of stuff that I did not pay attention to because I was so dependent on the people taking care of me to pick up on things. Mm. And yeah. And John was so preoccupied with our kids. They were in preschool and kindergarten. I mean, you're talking, you know, it was Christmas time. He had to worry about Santa and not, you know, we actually ended up one of the hospitalizations, I remember that he called my mom in the middle of the night. And he'll be really upset that I am saying this, but he called my mom really upset. And said, there's a huge leak in Alicia's closet. The whole closet just came down. So there were like squirrels or something that chewed through a pipe and caused a giant leak in our master closet. And so in the middle of everything else, now he's dealing with having to call flood, you know, the flood people and the fans. And he's worried about trying to get to see me and make sure our kids are fed and at school. And now we have like a massive home disaster happening. So, you know, it's so important that you have people around you that can advocate for you. Because as a patient, for me, I became like an idiot. And I don't mean that offensively to people who are not medical, but considering my medical background, I became completely oblivious to, you know, what should be going on. And as a patient, I was not, when I didn't want to walk, I didn't want to walk. When I didn't want to use my incentive spirometer and they're telling me I need to, like, there was no motivation because I was just so down and out. You know, there was none of my normal drive came in when they said you can't leave until you eat a bowl of grits or some kind of breakfast. And I stared at that grits like we were having a duel. I mean, I remember staring at that right before New Year's and they said, you can't until you eat. Cause I was on tube feedings and because I couldn't eat. And they said, if you can eat and tolerate breakfast, you can go home. And I wanted to go home more than anything in the world, because I really mainly wanted to go home to my family and just to my bed. And man, those grits and I had a stare down, and I finally got them down, but it was hard. And, you know, as a caregiver, when you're on the other side, you think, why don't you just do it? You know, just eat the grits. What's the big deal? Get, you know, walk that lap or do your incentive spirometer. But when you're a patient, there's so much more psychologically and emotionally that come in that's above the physical. And it takes over your mind. So I was not a smart patient and a compliant patient, you know, when it came to doing the things that you had to kind of, that I had to do on my own, I guess. So I think that answered your question. I know that was a lot, but I did not necessarily advocate for myself. I really depended on others.
No, that's really powerful in so many parts. And, you know, it's interesting because knowing you, I actually was, I don't even know where I was. I think I was in California when that happened, but I was not here. And so I was not physically part of that. And so hearing your story and hearing all these pieces of it, including the emotions and the thoughts that went through it, and your experience as a patient, there's so many things that come up for me. You know, one is knowing how independent you are and hearing your vulnerability as a patient and really just inability to have the energy to do the research and the things that you normally would do. And I feel like those are the times that we really understand and get a hold of the empathy that we need as healthcare professionals is to live it, you know, and I don't know how else, unless we live it personally or see a family member live it and we live it along with them, it's hard to get that, you know, degree of empathy and understanding of, yeah, we throw on the word, you know, compliant and we think many times, why can't they just do what we instructed and why aren't they doing this? And to understand that and to hear why and how you felt of why you couldn't do some of the things and how it really is significant being on that side of the equation. And we take that for granted when we have had our health and we don't know it until we don't. So really,
yeah. 100%. And another thing I want to add, just as being, because since then, and I know you know this, but just for the listeners, you know, I've been a caregiver now. When my dad had a lung transplant and before he had a lung transplant when he was very sick, I remember having to almost talk my mom off the ledge because she was so frustrated when he would not get out of bed or walk a lap or do the incentive spirometer. And I remember telling her, Mom, I know I have been where he is right now. I know how it feels. I know he knows what needs to be done, but emotionally it's the last thing that you could ever picture yourself doing, which is whatever it is that you need to be doing. And you cannot understand that when you're sitting in your full health and in your full mind, your right everything. You cannot understand how somebody could sit there and you say, if you don't do this, you'll have pneumonia. Like, that's not scary enough. It's not. When you're sick, it's not. There's nothing that can overcome just that mental burden that's keeping you down. So it's really, I saw it so clearly living through that with him and having to tell my mom, Mom, look, because she could not understand it. She's not been through that. She's not been a critically ill patient. And it was really essential for me to be able to say, look, you need to go. I'm going to stay because I know what he's going through. And I would sit and talk to him and say, like, I totally get it. I know this is how you feel. And I remember him agreeing with me, like, yeah, like nobody understands that. Nobody else has understood that. And I would have to tell my mom, like, Mom, you've got to lay off. He's not doing this because he doesn't want to live or he doesn't love you or whatever. He does not have control over this. And I think the mental health portion of that is severely overlooked. There were so many times where I said, can somebody please evaluate, you know, and now we're switching over to my dad, but we're, you know, evaluate the mental health burden of this illness or of any illness on a patient when there's a medical condition to check in and make sure that psychologically they're okay. And for me, I was already going in with depression. So I already knew I was already treated. So thank God. I actually developed anxiety about 6 months after all of it was done. I did not, the only time I cried, I think the entire time, and I'm typically I can be a pretty emotional person, And the only time that I cried the whole time was when they told me I was going to have surgery and I'd be in the hospital over Christmas because of my kids. And I thought, okay, Adeline is going, you know, it's going to be her third birthday and it's going to be Christmas. And she is not going to understand why I'm not home. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't remember any of it, thank God. But I did. And so
right.
That was really the only time, even when that nurse practitioner came in and told me I had a mass, I didn't cry. I was in such shock. And I kind of kept it emotionally together the whole time because I think my body knew that there was no good to me having a breakdown. And it wasn't until I went back to work in about 4 to 5 months after everything was done, I developed severe anxiety completely out of the blue. And I went back into kind of a depression relapse, even though I was treated, you know, and because I've had depression since college, actually probably since second grade. But and I went into a pretty almost like a post-traumatic months down the road. It really all hit me of how close I came to not making it out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so much more involved than I think we as healthcare professionals can ever know until we're either in that position, like I said, or with somebody who we love. And even with my advocacy clients now, I mean, I hear it. I sit down and I hear it and I hear them say, you know, I think I have PTSD from, you know, whatever just happened. And it's legitimate and it's a problem and it's not necessarily addressed. And I even remember with my own dad, you know, the one and only person his entire year of struggle with cancer that asked him how he was doing was the, you know, registered dietitian that I took him to just on my own, who said, "How are you doing with your diagnosis?" And it like hit me that nobody's asked that. And that's such a powerful question. So yes to all of that, such important pieces that unfortunately, just because of the, you know, overburdened system are just that's not really on the table to even address or talk about. It's very much the focus on getting you medically treated, which of course is extremely important. And you had an amazing team. And of course, we're also so grateful for that. But that is an important piece that I think is largely missing. So the patient advocate in me wants to ask, what would you say you had in place then that you are grateful for? And what do you wish you had or knew now that you did not know then?
I'm really grateful that I had my mom and my husband, who are both medically trained. So my mom was there and kind of more of the mom, like a support system, right? So I'm really grateful that I was able to have my mom there so that she could, if I was afraid to speak up because, oh, that nurse might not like that, I don't want her to mess with my IV or whatever, that she was, besides being an employee, which I should not have gotten different treatment than any other patient. But the fact of the matter is I did, because they knew my mom worked there. And, you know, that was a really, it's to me, it's really good to know somebody at the place that you're going, just because you have somebody that if you have an issue, they can find you an answer. So it was good to kind of have an advocate there just in my mom and being there with me so that if something was going on that I wasn't able to speak up for, that she could speak up for. Having my husband advocate for me as well. I actually think it was my husband that detected that after my second surgery, I was so drugged out. They had me on so much opioids, I couldn't even open my eyes. And I think he was the one that said, somebody needs to look and see, like, why is she so sedated? And it ended up that they had totally overdone the opioids. They gave me so much, like, I don't remember my family coming Christmas Eve with Chinese food. That was our whole thing, that they were going to come just like the Christmas story. And they ended up that I couldn't even open my eyes. I remember hearing them, but I was so sedated. And the next day somebody was like, oh shoot, I guess we should back down on all of the opioids. So having that in place, I think if I could have done it again, I would have specifically identified somebody to advocate for me. So my friends that kind of came forward for me and identified like the infection and the PIC line, you know, messing with my heart rhythm. And I think I would have had a more formal, hey, can you be by my side and make sure that what they're doing is right? Because mm-hmm. I know that I could not have. And to depend on my family to do that was very, would have been very difficult, especially with my mom working there. You know, she can't exactly go look under a magnifying glass, everything that gets done. But I think I would have felt more comfortable with that.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's such an important piece to kind of have. I mean, it's really great if you can have those pieces before anything were to happen, you know, like even have those discussions with close friends to say, you know, hey, if anything ever happens, you know, where I need somebody, would you be willing to be that advocate for me? But then definitely if we don't have that in place well in advance to name that person, it's almost like, you know, if you are in a situation where you have to give CPR and you have to say, you know, you call 911, I feel like it's that kind of an identification of, you know, can you please be the person who's looking over things for me? And that's a powerful insight that I think would help a lot of people, is just to have that one person. And yeah, it is hard when it's family, and sometimes that's all we have. And some of us, you know, definitely have a larger circle of people who are well versed in the medical system, but whoever you might be able to name, even if it's not somebody in the medical system, but somebody who you feel like could take the reins and, you know, and get an understanding, or at least, you know, make some decisions and share those insights from the doctors with you, because I do feel like you miss a lot in the communication. You're just trying to process your own healing. And even as a medical professional, definitely not as a medical professional, it's really hard to process all that's coming at you, because it comes at you very fast. You get a very quick visit with the specialists involved in your care, and you don't get much time to process. So super, super valuable. What would Alicia of today say to Alicia then? So the Alicia who was sitting, you know, let's say the Alicia who was sitting scared between the CT and the MRI, who didn't know what was coming, you know, in that anxiety state, what would Alicia today say to her?
Huh. That's a good one. I'm not going to cry. I think that having faith in a higher power to put us where we need to be when we need to be there. I think that Alicia today was talking to Alicia back then, because I'm a devout Catholic. I go to church, because my mom says I have to, like most Catholics. I don't find myself a lot of times like randomly praying or randomly talking to God. And I wish that I had the kind of faith and the kind of spiritual life that I was doing that, but it's just not something that's come naturally to me. That day in that MRI, I was talking to God. Mm-hmm. I was speaking those words, and I was saying, I'm giving this to you. And there was many a time since then that I have heard a song come on the radio, whether it be with my own health or with my dad, that I know that that was there for, that that song came on for a reason. And I talked to God, like I talked like he was sitting next to me, like, okay, I hear you. I'm giving this to you. You will take care of this. And I know that you will put me where I need to be, and just do what, you know, your will by thy will be done. I had to trust that whatever was going to happen was meant to happen. And since then, it has been so much of just fulfilling what I'm passionate about. I mean, I didn't like run away and, you know, go and travel the world and anything, but we certainly have a new appreciation in the last, you know, almost nine years since this has happened, have had a new appreciation for life. What's worth getting hyper over, what's not, what life is all about, experiences over things, and just doing the things that make you happy and making sure that those around you have what makes them happy. So for us, it's our kids, you know, they depend on us for most of their happiness. So making sure that they have the experiences and get to do the things in life that make them happy.
Yeah.
Over everything. Yeah.
I definitely think that these instances and yours and John's are definitely a lot more involved than, you know, something quick and easy, but definitely give us a different perspective. And, you know, you and I both went through this with our dads, and sometimes these perspective shifts are almost necessary for us to start appreciating life in a new way. And so but with you and John both experiencing such significant experiences as patients, I can only imagine, and I see it in our friendship and with you both, that you just have a new lease on life and a new understanding and a new sense of purpose. And that's, you know, the good side of it, of course. And thank goodness that both of you are doing so well. And we're certainly grateful for that. What would you say is your biggest piece of advice for those who maybe are used to not necessarily listening to their bodies as much? You know, maybe the Alicia, you know, of the past who wanted to quiet down the pain and make it go away and not necessarily follow through on it. What would you say to those people? You know, what would your advice be?
There's a reason that we have medical professionals. There is a reason that there's an emergency room. There's a reason that there's walk-in clinics. I almost was that same person again a couple weeks ago when I had abdominal pain again, and I was trying to kind of push it out of my mind. And then I thought, wait a second, this is the opposite of everything I stand for. The biggest thing with anything that happens to me, I always see it as an opportunity. If I get through it, which I obviously have gotten through everything that's happened to me so far, and nothing has killed me yet, knock on wood, my purpose is to spread the information and tell others and learn from what I went through. So when it comes to my whole health issues back then and all the way up to now, my biggest advice for people is not to go freak out and every time you have a cramp to go get a full body PET scan, but listen to your body. You know when something is not right. If you get this, you know, a headache every day, and it's not what normally is, or it's not raining out or whatever, if something is not right, go get it checked out. The worst that could happen, the best that could happen is that you go and they're like, there's nothing wrong with you, you know, and here's something to make that better, or maybe you need to change your diet or something. But when you're getting that nagging feeling that something is wrong, check it out. And it's a fine line, I know, between being a hypochondriac. And I remember after this happened, I did have some friends that would text me and say, okay, wait, what? Where was that pain that you had? Because I'm having, you don't have pancreatic cancer. Your left leg hurts because you ran. It's not because you have cancer. Like there's a fine line between every ache and pain running and getting testing that's unnecessary and clogging up the medical system versus, hey, this is out of the ordinary. I have this heaviness in my chest or this belly pain that's not going away or a headache that's really persistent. Go get it checked out and at least have peace of mind that everything is fine or what you can do for that. So I'm just a really big advocate for listening to your body and knowing what's normal and, you know, what is abnormal for you, and not necessarily, you know, listen and go and seek assistance. Don't get on the computer and look it up, because Dr. Google is not typically the best place to start.
Yes. I feel like Dr. Google is nothing but terrifying and anxiety ridden.
I mean, it is.
Yeah. It's so important, because I feel like even with, you know, us as healthcare professionals, I feel like we're a little bit worse with regard to wanting to utilize resources. You know, we don't want to bother the ER. We don't want to bother, you know, our friends who might be doctors. Like, we just don't want to bother anybody. The point is yes, we have these resources, and if you feel that you need them, if you have your body telling you that you need them, then use them. That's what they're there for. And I think sometimes we just need that basic, simple reminder.
And things can get so much worse when they're ignored. So if you think of somebody that's in the early stages of a heart attack, or, you know, you get early intervention, then, you know, you can like possibly not die, but also not do really, you know, if you make it past it, you also could do really, really significant damage to your heart or to, you know, whatever. So ignoring things, John had a similar, this nagging weird chest pain down his arm. And He went and had all the tests done. No, everything's normal. And he's like, something's not right. And he persisted. And they ended up doing a different test and found that he had almost 100% blockages in three of his main major arteries. For somebody in their 40s, that is not a normal finding. So he ended up having stents, and they were shocked that they found that. But he knew something was wrong, and he persisted. Even though everybody read the test and said, nope, you're fine, he said, but this is still happening. So listen to your body, and don't be afraid to speak up for yourself. That's the biggest thing I see, is so many people, and I was that person as a patient, that sit back and just, well, they know what they're, everyone knows what they're doing. They're going to do the right thing. Not to say that medical professionals don't, but they're humans just like we're humans. And somebody can misread a label. Somebody can misread a chart. And maybe, you know, stop before that next test that needed to be done. Advocate for yourself. You only get one life. So you have to speak up for yourself and not be worried about other people's feelings.
Yes. In fact, I just had this conversation on my last episode, and, you know, I likened it and used the analogy that a lot of people, I think, feel that it's like a restaurant, you know, where you don't speak up or they're going to spit in your food or, you know, some, and that's just, it's not the same. And you really have to ask the questions. And I can't even tell you how many times as an advocate for people that the physicians thank me after I bring things up. So it's not that they don't want you to question. It's not that they don't want you to speak up for yourself. They want you healthy just as much as you want you healthy. But, you know, sometimes they don't, you know, they don't know if the tests all say negative and you don't speak up, then they think you're fine. But if you do, then they can proceed with other tests. And so it's not that you're making anybody upset. And honestly, if you do make somebody upset, it's still okay because you still need to speak up for yourself. But in general, the medical team wants the best for you. And in the end, they will tell you did the right thing by speaking up. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times they tell me, thank you for, you know, asking about this medication and clarifying this and helping them clean this list up. And they really do want the best. And they simply, you know, like I mentioned, are overburdened. And yes, you're right. They're human, and errors are going to happen, not because of malintention on their part. It's just the way it is. So I think what I would love to end on is your feelings as you turned 40 and as you thought back to what they told you, which was, you know, this, what could have been a pancreatic cancer diagnosis at the age of 40. How did your turning of 40 and your just sort of evaluating where you are and where you could have been if you had not listened to your body, what were those thoughts and feelings?
I really did have reflected this year. And every time I think about the fact, those words that that my surgeon used and said by age 40, she would have had full-blown pancreatic cancer. I have to think, every time I think of my age, like, this would have been the year, right? If he was right, he's one of the best. If this would have been the year. And I'm so grateful that I did not let the emotional burden of that diagnosis and that whole event, you know, whatever you call it, that whole experience, bring me down. Let me live in that place of, oh my gosh, that could have been.
So yeah, I mean, basically living in gratitude over what did occur and the resolution that did occur rather than the fear of what could have been, because I think you could easily have lived in fear of, well, what if they're wrong? And what if they didn't get it all? And what if I still am gonna potentially face that diagnosis in the future, versus just extreme gratitude for what did occur and what was caught early and how well you're doing now.
Yeah, that's really what the last 8.5 years have been, is live life to the fullest, you know, go on the trip, buy the bag, buy the shoes, whatever, do what needs to be done, and just try to keep focused on the important things in life. And yeah, listening to your body. And another thing that really was impactful for me during this time was the amount of support and friendships that came out of me being sick. I had I had two of my very closest friends at work, besides the two nurses that are close friends, but two of my very closest pharmacist friends at work arrange a meal train for me, and they fed not really for me, because I was in the hospital being fed, my husband and my children, and my family was fed for the entire 5 months, Monday through Friday, dinner on the table every single day. My neighbor at the time, and she's moved away, and we've moved to a different house, but my neighbor at the time pretty much raised my kids during that time so that John could, you know, he was still working, so he could go to work and come straight to the hospital. So she would pick up the kids from school and from preschool and sit at she would tell me stories that she'd sit at the kitchen table and say, well, I wonder who's bringing us dinner tonight, you know. And and my friends fed my VA family fed my family for 5 months straight. Not one night was missed. Awesome. Which that to me is like the most impactful thing out of all of it. And now I know, you know, ever since then, somebody's sick, somebody has something happen, food, bring them food, bring their family food. They don't want to have, they should not have to worry about that. It goes well with my background to feed people, but that's another thing that really, I have this new appreciation for what being a good friend is and what people need at times like that. It's, you know, flowers are nice and all, but feed my kids, mm-hmm. feed my husband and my kids, so that when I come home, I don't have to worry about stuff piling up and them being hungry and not being able to move. Cause I was, you know, really immobilized for a lot of the time, and take care of my family. And that was just the biggest thing that ever could have happened for me. Mm-hmm.
And you and your mom so paid that forward, because when my dad was sick, I remember you guys feeding us. And I remember another friend of mine in Gainesville, you know, just calling and saying, tell me your order for subs. You know, it wasn't the question of what can I do to help, or let me know what I can do, because we aren't going to say, give us food, you know, but right. To just do it. And sometimes that's what people need, is just go ahead and do it, and they will appreciate it. So I am so grateful for all of this, for your friendship, for your insights. So grateful that you and John are such shining lights for others. And thank you so much for coming on.
Oh my gosh, it was an honor.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Minding Wellness Podcast. What a great episode, reminding us to listen to our bodies. We have such resilient physical bodies that do their best to give us the signals that we need. And all we need to do is pay attention to those, listen to those, and then seek medical attention when we need it. I'm so grateful for Alicia reminding us of that through her powerful story. If this episode resonated with you and inspired you, I would love it and appreciate it if you would leave me an iTunes review so others can find us as well. I can't wait to see you here again next time.